Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here in the state today with our two guests. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way, our guests Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. David, a professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology in that same department at UW-Madison. And, of course, he's also with UW Extension. And they come by on a regular basis to give you and I and me an update on what's going on with our wildlife. You may have questions, concerns. Maybe you've got an interesting photo to share. If you got a photo, you can and a question, you can go to our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the name. You can phone us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jamie Knack, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here, Larry.
Yeah, and David, great to have you back as well.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
You know, this whole white nose syndrome business it's awful. I think we really should be concerned about this, right?
Yes, for a whole host of reasons. And so just to update the listeners really quick, white nose syndrome is a relatively new disease that has become very insidious, has drastic consequences for hibernating bats. It was first found in a cave system just outside Albany, New York in 2006 and has since spread to about 28 states in the United States. I just looked at the map recently. It's out in Washington State, that far west. But more locally, it's hit Wisconsin. And so white nose syndrome is caused by a fungus that is found in the cave system. And the reason it's called white nose syndrome is it looks like somebody's taken a bat, and a bat that's susceptible or infected with white nose syndrome. It looks like they've taken it and just kind of dipped its nose or its face into powdered sugar. It's got a white fungus around the facial area, and as that disease progresses on the animal, it will start eating holes in the wings of the bats. And again, this happens when they're hibernating, so it is only the bats that are susceptible are those hibernating bats in the wintertime. But what occurs when they are infected with white nose syndrome is it causes them to wake up. And as they wake up, they have to burn valuable energy to go from that hibernatory state to a more active state. Obviously, their food source is not available in the wintertime, and a lot of times these bats die of either dehydration or hypothermia or something like that. And so it is a very real consequence to bats. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has been monitoring our state hibernaculums for quite some time since this first occurred in 2006. And they first found it a couple years ago down in Grant County in the southwesternmost county of Wisconsin. And since then, they constantly do a monitoring of all the cave systems throughout the wintertime. The most recent results they just released is they examined 74 different hibernaculum sites this past winter, found it in 42, so more than 50% of the sites now. And it's spread to six additional counties. So it's primarily in the southwestern part of Wisconsin, but it is on the western extreme, eastern extreme of Wisconsin, up in the north central and northwestern part of the Wisconsin as well. And just to show you how devastating this can be, the mine that they went into in Grant County, they go back and they'll resurvey that same mine. And, and since the first time they found it there, now they've seen a 94% decrease in the bat population in that one particular mine. Another cave system they examined in 2015, they went back in 2016 and they found no bats in that cave system. So it can have very, very devastating consequences. Obviously, bats are part of our natural ecosystem here. You know, they do a phenomenal job of insect control, pest control. Some bats are pollinator species and things like that. So they're very, very valuable to our ecosystem, and it really is a shame to see what's happening.
Yeah, and how do you control? I mean, how do you control wild bats?
And there's been a lot of research going on. I mean, there's funding and research going on potential solutions to it, but they've been pretty few and far between at this point. Everybody's pretty
really
desperate
sad.
for a cure. So I think nationwide, the estimate is 6 million.
Mm-hmm.
Bats at this point have died from the disease, and it continues to spread. So,
and Lynn on Facebook just reported that she used to have bats in their pole building up in the garage door. She only saw one or two last summer, and they had hundreds.
Yeah,
and they were as plentiful as swallows. She's in central Wisconsin on Pleasant Lake and Washera County.
Yeah, they have not, to my knowledge, they have not found white nose syndrome in the central part of the state yet. And we do want to caution, just because you don't see bats in your area this year and you might have seen them last year, there could be a whole host of reasons why that is,
and it,
that have nothing to do with white nose syndrome. And part of it is, obviously, these are very mobile species, and they do move around based on where the food availability is and things like that. And sometimes we may be more or less observant from year to year as human beings. And so we do want to caution people that just because you don't see them, it does not necessarily mean it's white nose syndrome.
Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Jamie Nack and David Drake of UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Questions about wildlife or something to share about something you've observed? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. It's pretty exciting news for bird watchers. You know, it's the sighting of a bird that hasn't been seen here since, was 1873, I think?
1873, yeah. And that's a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So a couple of very experienced birders out on Lake Michigan saw what they found to be a white-winged tern. And what makes this so unique and so interesting and exciting for, especially if you're a birder, is white-winged terns are not even found in North America. They typically are found in Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, and things like that. And so for it to be here in the central part of the United States especially is remarkable. They are what they're called a vagrant if they're not native to an area and not normally found there. They're referred to as a casual vagrant out east in the eastern part of the United States because occasionally they will show up along the Atlantic coast and in parts of Canada and things like that. But what was kind of interesting about this is so terns are very long-distance migratory species, and we've got a number of terns here in the state of Wisconsin that are native to Wisconsin, black tern, common tern, things like that. When these white-winged terns show up in America, they typically show up in flocks of black terns. And what was funny reading the newspaper account out of Milwaukee is that the two birders who saw the white-winged tern, they saw it amongst a flock of black terns. And one of the birders, and both of these birders are very experienced birders, they said to the other, "Hey, look at that funny-looking black tern." And the other one said, "I think that's a white-winged tern." And they started looking at it a little bit closer, and sure enough, it was a white-winged tern. And where they found it is actually where it was pretty good tern habitat for white-winged terns, be it in Wisconsin or in Eastern Europe, but they found it in an impoundment in off Lake Michigan. And white-winged terns at this time of the year are breeding, and they typically would breed in inland freshwater lakes and swampy areas and things like that. So it's very, very unusual to find it in Wisconsin, but the circumstances about it being in a flock of black terns and being in an inland freshwater lake is not that uncommon based on where that animal's native range would be.
Very, very interesting. Are there speculations? Sometimes just a vagrant like that, it just gets on the winds or just decides to go. People, I've often heard on the show, people are wondering if climate change is causing us to see more birds of species.
Yeah, you know, my personal opinion, Larry, is probably it was a male. It took a wrong left turn at the light and never stopped to ask for directions, but that's just me. No, I think most of them is, you know, the typical thought for these vagrants is, especially deer migration, they get blown off course by a storm. They fall in with another group of flocking, migratory animal birds, and they just follow those animals. Or it might be, the first northward migration for a young, inexperienced animal, and it just lost its way and kind of started continuing to go west, so to speak. And so nobody's exactly sure why it's here, but I'll tell you, things like this sure do get the birding world awfully excited. And from all accounts, people were just flocking from everywhere to come see it because it was such a rare bird.
Laura in New Berlin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Laura. Thank you for calling.
Hello. It just occurred to me when Mr. Drake mentioned the year 2006 as being the discovery of white nose syndrome, even though I've never heard it mentioned together. Did either of the guests ever think there could be a connection between white nose syndrome and colony collapse disorder with honeybees, because 2006 was linked with that malady also.
Hmm.
And thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Interesting question there.
Yeah, Laura, thank you very much for the question. I have not seen anything in the literature, in the scientific literature, that makes that connection or that link. And you know, if you think about kind of the timing of all of this, it probably would be very unusual for any link between colony collapse of bees and white nose syndrome in bats to occur, because obviously the bees are also hibernatory. If they're up here, they kind of go to bed for the winter. Some people move their colonies south so the bees can stay active year-round, whereas the bats are they're in hibernation all winter long, and so the bats and the bees don't really interact during that time when white nose syndrome is so prevalent in the wintertime. And my understanding of colony collapse, I think the jury is still out on this, but what seems to be they're pointing toward nicotinoid poisoning, mm-hmm. For the colony collapse, and that doesn't have anything to do with white nose syndrome and that the fungal disease that's found in the cave system.
We have Rusty and Stevens Point on board next. Hi, Rusty. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. This may seem like an odd one, but I'm up here at Stevens Point, Rudolph area. Maybe 20 years ago, there was a local fella who was raising, you know, deer. He had some white tails, and then he actually had a dozen or so of these. They weren't albino deer, but they were a pure white deer. Unfortunately, they got chased through the fence by some dogs, so some of them escaped, some of them died. And these white deer are able to breed and mate with whitetails, and what they say is usually one or two out of every seven fawns can be white. At first, it was kind of a neat phenomenon. You'd see these white deer every once in a while, but you can't shoot them because they are white, even though they're not an albino, and they're starting to spread out. And I'm wondering, is this going to become a problem in the future? Like I said, this may have happened over 20 years now, but yeah. There's white deer all over the place out here.
Hmm. All right, thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's get a comment.
Thanks for the call, Rusty. You know, white deer, you know, the captive, six captive deer, I don't know how long ago that was, but it'd be...
sounded like 20 years or so.
Yeah, it'd be pretty unlikely that, I mean, obviously that those specific deer are still alive.
They wouldn't be around.
And yeah, it wouldn't take too many years with the predators and so on for them to pass. So, you know, if you're seeing white deer right now, I would guess that those are coming from, you know, they're albino or piebald, which is not pure albino deer, but a slight albinism with their coat color. And, you know, they do occur in the state to have albino deer, and they are currently protected. And they can sometimes be in, same with a melanistic gray squirrel that's black. They tend to occur in certain areas because it is a genetic condition, so that trait can get passed on in a local area. So you might have an area of the state where you tend to see more black squirrels or a little bit more prevalence of white deer. But I haven't heard anything in the literature about, you know, these white deer and continuing to have offspring as a result of those captive deer escaping. But certainly having albino whitetails is something that does occur in nature. So...
Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Net. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake. Questions? Join in. Experiences to share? Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jerry in Blair, Wisconsin. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Larry, and to your guests as well. We have a strange bird here that's frequenting our lawn, and it's got all the characteristics of a robin, except it doesn't have the color. It's mostly white and with some black trim, wingtips and back of the neck, and then there's a stripe down the middle of the back. And like I say, it acts exactly like a robin, But I'm just wondering if it might be an albino version, but I've seen pictures of albino robins, and they seem to have an orange breast, so I guess I'm totally puzzled on it. I see it every day. I just seen it now a couple minutes ago again.
So its whole its breast is all white feathers?
It's all white.
Oh, okay.
Jerry, from the description of it, it sounds like you probably are identifying the bird correctly. It probably is a robin, and robins are so common. Certainly in the shape of that animal. You know, they have that kind of plump, roundish breast and belly.
And it hunts as a robin would, you know, for worms.
Yep. So it sounds like you've got the identification correct, and it's just a matter of why is that animal kind of that melanistic color it is, as Jamie was talking about with the white deer.
Yeah.
And it could be a couple of reasons. Maybe there is something in the genetic code of that animal that is causing it to be white. But and that probably is most likely what the problem is. Occasionally, we'll see birds, or we'll get accounts of birds. For example, a cardinal that may have a blue tail, and sometimes with the bird's feathers, there can be structural damage to that feather. And the way that feather with the structural damage, then that feather, instead of absorbing one color of light and reflecting all the other colors of light, it changes the colors it's absorbing versus reflecting, and all of a sudden you get this abnormally colored bird that you know is a cardinal, for example, or you know is a robin.
Yeah.
But most likely what it sounds like is you've got a robin there that is just melanistic, and it probably is, you know, for an animal to be true albino, and that typically happens more in mammals, that the nose has to be pink and the eyes have to be pink. If it's not a true albino, we typically refer to that animal as piebald. And that sounds like what you may have is a piebald type robin.
Yeah, well, yeah. It looks and acts like a robin, and I think it thinks it is a robin.
I wouldn't doubt it a bit, Jerry.
Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, thanks. That was great. Rusty and Stevens Point, thanks for calling.
See, I was listening to the response to my earlier call, and I'm kind of disappointed that your guest just wrote off the fact that it's simply a piebald or a albino and those deer didn't continue. We know for a fact that these deer continue. There's currently a white-tailed doe with two white fawns and a brown fawn. There's over a dozen of these white deer in the central Wisconsin area right now. I really think that before you write it off, you guys might want to take
a look at it. Okay. Yeah. So, all right. Thanks, Rusty.
Yeah, certainly not writing it off. Definitely, you know, believe the encounter. It's a matter of, you know, where that genetics are continuing to come from. And just mentioning that having white deer in the wild, white-tailed deer herd in Wisconsin is a phenomenon that does occur, and it occurs more frequently than melanism, which would be a black deer, which I think we've only documented just a few times in the last 100 years. So anyway, I mean, white deer are something that do occur naturally. As far as speaking to the captive escape of some white deer, whether those were white tails or a different species of captive held deer, I'm not aware of that situation. And, you know, perhaps calling the local wildlife biologist, there might be some more history in your area about those deer, and they might be able to lend some more background on any potential escape.
I wish the wildlife biologist was listening right now. It'd be fun to have that person on who no doubt would have some more background relating to what Rusty is talking about. Rusty, thanks again. We didn't want to minimize your comments by any means. So we'll check on that. Why don't we look into that? Check up there. Yeah. Check with a wildlife biologist up there, and next time you're on, we can talk about it again.
Well, you may even want to just do a quick search on the internet, because I know over by where I live, there's somebody in their front yard. I drive by it almost every day. They've got a sign that says "Protect the Rare White Deer in Wisconsin." And so I don't know if there's a movement afoot, or if there's a group that's been assembled to focus on this a little bit. Maybe do a quick internet search and see what comes up.
Well, that, David, had to do with chronic wasting disease. And at the time of chronic wasting disease discovery, white deer were not protected in the chronic wasting disease zone because of the concern for spreading the disease. So it was just felt that, you know, no deer should be protected within the area of disease management. So There was, I mean, a lot of people feel, you know, white deer when they see them. They are unusual. Yeah. It's not something you see every day and consider them sacred and, you know, want to protect them. So I think that's where that signage was coming from.
Yeah, I haven't seen one yet in the field. So I'd love to do that. So I'd love to see one sometime. Lots of photos. I mean, hundreds of photos of them. Jim in St. Croix Falls, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about bat houses. Is it a good idea to put up bat houses? Where should they be positioned? And I have what I think would be a good place, but it's right over the garage with a garage door opener, and I wonder if that would interfere.
Yeah, so thanks for the question, Jim. Bat houses in the state of Wisconsin, and there's certainly designs available. I'll start out with some resources. One would be go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources page, and in their search engine, type in bat houses. There will be plans for building them and also suggestions on where to best locate them and how to encourage bats to use them. And the other site would be Bat Conservation International, which is batcon.org, and they're a worldwide organization conserving and protecting bats around the world. So with the bat houses in our state, with the colder temperatures, we'd want to have those painted either brown or black to absorb more of the sun's energy and heat. And locations, if you can mount them on a pole in an open area, the bats that we have here are all insect eaters and they eat flying insects. So they want, you know, areas to move around and be able to maneuver and catch those insects. So on a pole as high up as you can get it in an open area, if you have a water, a pond, or a small lake or anything like that, those, again, are great places because they'll catch the insects above the water. And otherwise, another great location would be on the south or east-facing side of a home or a building. But as you had mentioned or are asking about, you do want to be careful about placing them over a doorway because the droppings will fall out. The bat house is not contained like a birdhouse. It has an open bottom that allows the droppings to fall. So you don't want to place that over a door. I don't know that your garage door opener or the garage door opening and closing is necessarily going to deter bats. I would, you know, prioritize a south or east facing side and just out of from being above a door that you're going in and out of. So again, both of those websites have excellent sources for how to build the bat houses and then also information on how to locate them.
There we go.
One more thing. The best features, do you know, like some of them say that you should have a fabric lining and some say not.
Yeah, again, I would refer to those sources. They, you know, are kind of the scientific, you know, gateway to the information on how to build these bat houses. So the other thing, I mean, you can purchase them. If you're going to purchase them in a store, I would encourage you to make sure that they are BCI, so Bat Conservation International certified. So you can buy and purchase your own bat houses. Just look for some type of authentication that they're certified, which means they were built to the standards of Bat Conservation International. So, but again, I'd refer you to those sites for some more specifics on the building process.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have Ann in Green Bay up next. Hi, Ann. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Well, I'm just wondering, if we're so concerned about the white nose syndrome, why aren't we under some kind of national or international spelunking ban for a couple of years until the bats can start to recover?
Yeah, Ann, that's a good question. It depends on where the cave is located, but there are certainly caves now in Wisconsin that have been barred so that it prevents people from going in. I mean, they literally have metal bars so the bats can come and go, but people cannot. Other caves are still open, but the DNR and the spelunking community, or the community of people who are cavers, that they're working very closely with each other, and there are some very strict decontamination protocols where if you go into one cave as a spelunker, you need to follow this decontamination protocol before you take that same equipment into a different cave, because you can spread the fungus from one cave to the next cave. So there is great awareness amongst the caving community and the scientific community about the potential risk of spreading this disease as you go from cave to cave. But the other benefit, however, for having people in the caves is you've got extra eyes in there looking out for white nose syndrome. And a lot of the spelunking community is very, very aware of this and are reporting potential cave sites that maybe the DNR or other wildlife agencies have not examined yet. And if I recall the story correctly, that first cave where white nose syndrome was found up in upstate New York in 2006, I believe the reason that the wildlife authorities were first alerted to that is because some cavers had been in there and they came out and they saw dead bats at the cave entrance and they contacted the wildlife agency and then they started to investigate and found white nose syndrome. So the cavers can be very, very beneficial, although as you rightly are concerned, they can also be detrimental if they're not careful about decontamination.
Great question. Thank you so much for calling. And let's take another call. David from Wausau up next. Hi, David.
Hello?
Hi, David. Larry Mueller here. What's up?
Hey. I'm sorry. you were talking about a robin, so a white robin.
Yeah.
We've had a leucistic. This is a term that Marge Gibson said I should use. Leucistic robin returned to our yard for 4 years now, and he's got really unique markings. His tail is pure white. His chest is mottled, and his head looks like he's got a black mohawk.
Very cool.
Yeah, and
I got to send the picture to Marge, and she said she's pretty sure it's a Lucas and not Lucerne.
So, you know, I wish you'd post a photo of that up on our Facebook page, David, if you can. I'd love to see the bird, and so would everybody else for that matter.
I will do that. I will do that. And so leucistic and what was the word you used? Starts with a P.
Yeah, piebald. And they would essentially mean the same thing. Leucistic.
Synonymous, then.
Yeah. Leucistic's probably more a reference term used in the bird community and piebald more, at least certainly with deer. So
yeah. I'll never forget the first time I saw them. I thought some poor bird flew through some spray painting booth. Hey, great show. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Don't forget now, post that up on our Facebook page. I want to see that leucistic. Was it Robin?
Yeah,
for sure. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You can email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, there's a really interesting program. I think that May 17th was the official start of Snapshot Wisconsin. Can you tell us about that program?
Yeah, this is a pretty huge undertaking,
yeah.
And it's been a couple years in the making and developing of the program, but it's a coordinated effort between UW-Madison, the Department of Natural Resources, and then also NASA. You wonder, well, why is NASA involved in this?
And UW-Extension.
And UW-Extension, correct. Yep, so it's essentially Snapshot Wisconsin is a volunteer program that is going to use volunteers to monitor using a network of trail cameras. So they are looking for landowners and educators. You could even use a camera on state forests, for example. They're looking for folks to host a trail camera and then download photos every couple of months into this huge collection of photos that then get categorized by the public. And the public could be anybody in the world sitting at their computers going through this crowdsourcing website to determine what is on the photo. And if it's a deer, you know, is it a male, a female, how many are in the picture, and so on. So it's a huge citizen science effort for the state. Right now they're working on deploying cameras in Sawyer and Iowa counties are the pilot counties that are being used right now. And so if folks do own land in those counties, I encourage you to go to the Department of Natural Resources website and keyword search Snapshot Wisconsin. And there should be information there on how you might get enrolled to host a camera. If you agree to do that, there will be a workshop where they train you on how they would like the camera placed, how to download photos, and so on. The goal is in the next year to roll out a couple additional counties and by 5 years potentially have cameras in every county of the state. So the camera data then gets funneled into a crowdsourcing website called Zooniverse that you can go on right now. There's projects all around the world. You can watch cameras at water holes in the Serengeti, and it's
really
just
cool.
Really yeah. neat. I mean, it's addicting. So
wait a minute. Now, where is it? People are saying, yeah, wait a minute, I didn't hear the name. What was that?
Zooniverse. So it's Zooniverse. And when you get there, you're looking for the Snapshot Wisconsin Project, and you can log in. It's a great thing to do with kids, or if you happen to be a teacher or in education, it might be something your class adopts and works towards. And then there's also a chat or a blog that go along with that particular project, so you can actually communicate with the biologists and the researchers that are on this project and ask questions. So there's a lot of information that you can learn from that aspect. And then this data, the hopes with the information is to help track animal populations, some unusual sightings. It's been
white deer.
Yeah, white deer is a possibility. Things like the movement of bobcats or fisher or bears, the new elk reintroduction projects, you know, to get some numbers, some estimates on their populations and kind of where they're moving. So the other thing is that this information, especially from the white-tailed deer standpoint, will be provided to the CDACs, which is the County Deer Advisory Committees, and it will be additional information they can use to make their management recommendations on the deer harvest for those counties. So a really exciting project. I encourage you to go to. There's been a lot of press release and articles about it. Paul Smith wrote about it in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've had press releases here at UW. But if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, you can learn more. There's just a lot of opportunities to get involved. So if you don't own land and don't have the ability to host a camera, you certainly can help catalog the photos. So this will be something we see for a number of years moving forward and hear about. So check it out.
Zooniverse
is the website to do the crowdsourcing, but Snapshot Wisconsin is the specific project.
Jill, we'll have to post that up on our Facebook page. So Zooniverse.
That's through the Alder Planetarium is who hosts Zooniverse out of Chicago.
Yeah, very, very cool. We'll get that up on our Facebook page. Zooniverse.
Zooniverse. Well, it's kind of fun
about,
to say.
It is fun to say. Lois in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go to her now. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I do have a question about bats. I do live in an old farmhouse, so they are present up in the rafters. And 2 years ago, I found a dead one on the patio. So I was wondering what is the correct thing to do if I should find another dead bat on the property?
Lois, that's a good question. You are welcome to call your county Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources biologist and ask them if they would like the bat for examination.
Right.
If it's a single bat or even, you know, one or two bats, I probably wouldn't worry about it too much because bats die of a whole host of causes. And by this time, once they get out of that cave system and they're done with hibernation, they are no longer susceptible to white nose syndrome until they go back into that cave system for the next period of hibernation next winter. But bats are susceptible to rabies, and that can certainly kill them. You know, there's plenty of other animals that prey on bats and will kill them. Sometimes, you know, they may fly into something and die from colliding with a window or whatever the case might be. So, like I said, if it's just one or two random bats and they're spaced out over a bit of time, I probably wouldn't worry too much about it. But if you are concerned, if you want to follow up on it, certainly call the DNR wildlife biologist in your county and see if they have any interest in taking the bat and examining further.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bob in Chippewa Falls, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Say, I've seen something a couple times now in different areas, and I'm kind of curious about it. In both cases, it was during the daylight, a lone white-tailed deer standing within 3 or 4 feet of a sandhill crane.
Yeah.
And they're just
sitting there
doing what they do.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there any kind of symbiotic relationship.
No, I don't think there's any symbiotic relationship per se. I think, you know, neither of them have fear you know, of each other. Neither of them are going to be a predator of the other. It's not uncommon to see deer and turkeys in the same manner in a field together. So they just have come to understand that there's plenty of food for each of them, and they really don't pose a threat to each other. So, yeah, it's something that we see quite frequently, especially at this time of the year.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I've seen it with turkeys more than sandhill cranes, but the turkeys a lot, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, we're up in Columbia County, so we've got a lot of cranes, and it's pretty common to see both in the same field, sure.
Well, let's go to Judy in Lodi next. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question. My daughter lives in Ingleside, Illinois, and she called me last night to tell me that they've got this, it's a coal wolf. It's a new breed. I guess they've been around for quite a while, and she took a picture of two of them crossing the road on her way to work in Illinois. And she doesn't know. I told her to call the DNR, and she said, Mom, I don't have time. She said, lucky enough, I got time to call you.
So she sent you a copy of that photo?
No, she didn't send me a copy. I told her to contact somebody on it, because there's a gentleman that's a farmer. He's got sheep, and he's been sighting them and killing them without contacting, you know, the authorities. And I told her, I said, it's not good that he's shooting them.
I wonder if it's...
And it's in Illinois.
Yeah.
And it's all wooded area around where she lives.
Okay. Well, what do you think?
I think that certainly there's been a lot of attention and interest in what's called coy wolves, with that breeding of a coyote with a wolf. I know just last week on PBS Nature, the coy wolf program was on for an hour, and so that probably got a lot of people's attention. A few months ago in the Atlantic, I think, a pretty mainstream publication, a story on coy wolves came out, and this story kind of cycles through every so often. So most likely what's going on, Judy, down there is your daughter is seeing coyotes, and coyotes and wolves can look very similar. They can be similarly colored. If you're just looking at one, or I know she saw two at a time, but if they're both coyotes, which most likely they are, it's kind of hard to sometimes tell those apart from wolves, especially at a distance. But wolves, they're certainly can travel down to Illinois, but typically they don't. And you may have a much more common chance, statistically speaking, of seeing a coyote than you do a wolf down where you're describing. In terms of coyotes and wolves breeding, that seems to be a little bit more of a prevalent issue out in the northeastern part of the United States and up into the Canadian Atlantic provinces, where they've done some genetic testing and they've seen it in some of the genetic lines up there. To my knowledge, in terms of looking for coy wolf breeding here, especially in the upper Midwest, they have not found it in some of the genetic testing they've done of both coyotes and wolves. So it does not seem to be an issue here. And when I say it's prevalent in Northeast, it's not as if it's really, really common out there. It's occasionally will show up, but it's not something that is terribly, terribly common out there as well. So my guess, Judy, is that your daughter has seen more coyotes. That's all she has seen is coyotes, and it's not a coy wolf, and it's not a wolf. And ask her to call you more often.
Yes. But if she has a photo, or if she sent you a photo, I'd love to see it anyway, and we can take a look at it here and help identify whether. I mean, it's hard to identify in a photo. Sometimes even somebody who knows, you know, is experienced in knowing the difference, it's hard from a distance to tell.
Yeah, and, you know, if you do have a coyote-wolf hybrid or, you know, a mix of coyote and wolves, they're going to have a little bit of each, and it's going to make it even more difficult to tell, is that a coyote or is that a pure wolf, whatever the case is. And one other thing, Larry, maybe we can click on or touch on quickly, is she mentioned something about the farmer is shooting these animals. And I'm not sure about the laws in Illinois, but I think it's like 37 or 40 states in the United States have essentially what they call an open season on coyotes. And so any time of the year, you can, on your own property, you can kill a coyote legally. And I'm guessing that's what the farmer is doing down there.
So there you go, Judy. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today from UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today, of course, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Jamie Nack and David Drake. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. And talking about a range of things, certainly bats have come up. We've had a lot of discussion about bats, about white deer, looking at everything from melanistic to...
Leucistic.
Leucistic.
Yeah.
Birds and animals. So there you go. You may have a question, or maybe you've got an experience to share. I hope you'll join us. Shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org or post a photo on our Facebook page along with a comment or question. The Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, the number 1-800-642-1234. Terry in Manitowoc, thanks for waiting. Hello.
No problem. Interesting program today. A couple of questions and a sighting. The questions are, and you can answer them off the air, but why in the deserts where some of the larger caves are, such as Carlsbad, you have a high concentration of bats, I mean thousands and thousands in one cave, but yet they live in a desert where, you know, there's not a lot of bugs because of waters or ponds and lakes? That's one question. The second one is that with the number of barns and antique older farm sets and stuff being demolished as they age, like the one caller said she had bats in her attic, does that have a direct impact on the population of bats in Wisconsin? And then, Larry, I'm sorry you haven't seen a white deer. I've seen several of them. Check up around Boulder Junction. They've got a herd up there of piebald, and I think there's some albino also. And then driving from Wapaka on Highway 10 back to the Valley, Appleton,
yep.
My granddaughter, she said she saw a bear in a driveway, so I turned around and backed up. This was on a county road, and it wasn't a bear. It was one of those black silhouettes. But then a few miles down the road, she says, Grandpa, there's a white deer. And I looked over like, yeah, sure, right. And she saw one. I saw two. And then 10 minutes later, before we got to Appleton, there was another one on an old railroad bed. So.
Well, thanks, Terry, for the tip and the directions.
I do know that Boulder Junction is one of those areas that, you know, has been mentioned in the past for having white deer.
Just through Boulder Junction a few weeks ago, and I didn't see it. There can't be any there because
I
didn't see
night?
One. No.
Well, maybe you should take his granddaughter with you.
Yeah, let her.
She'd be glad to take a road trip, Larry.
But now, that's an interesting question about the bats. You know, here they are in desert situations where the insect population, there's an insect population. Believe me, I've gotten plenty of mosquito bites out that way. But talk about why there are so many there. Is it the size of the cave?
So the Southwest has got a considerable bat population, considerable bat diversity in the southwestern part of the United States. And certainly bats, just like all other animals, they're adapted to that climate and that habitat where they live. And so they certainly are eating some of those insects down there. But they also, we've got bats that are fruit bats. We have bats that are nectivores, you know. They'll eat nectar out of plants and things like that. Obviously, our bats up here are primarily insectivores because we have got such an abundance of insects up here. And so, animals will adapt to their specific situation, that specific location, climate, things like that. And so I think that's probably the answer between, you know, what's going on up here versus in the southwestern United States is just a different climate, habitat. Down there, you know, they don't necessarily need to hibernate because it's warm enough. They can stay year-round, active year-round in their food source. And primarily the reason the animals hibernate, bats hibernate here, is because their primary source of food, the insects, are just not available. And they either have to leave this area if they want to stay active, mm-hmm. where the insects are, their food source is active and available year-round, or they have to hibernate.
And the loss of, that's an interesting point, too, the loss of silos and some of the old buildings. You see them disappearing across Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly this will maybe get to Bob's question on Facebook as well. Bob said he called to ask if all species of bats get white nose syndrome, and no, they typically do not, Bob. So we've got, in Wisconsin, for example, we have 7 species of bats. We used to have 8. The 8th was the Indiana bat, federally endangered. It hasn't been seen in Wisconsin since, you know, the early 1960s. So essentially we've got 7 species of bats. 4 are resident bat species here, and those are the hibernatory bats, so they hibernate during the wintertime. If you're a bat that hibernates, you're susceptible to white nose syndrome if that fungus is in that cave system. The other three bats we have are what we call migratory tree roosting bats. And so those three species leave our state when the weather starts getting colder in the fall, days get shorter. They go down into the southern part of the United States. They're more or less active year-round, and then they come back up in the spring. So those three migratory species of bats would not necessarily be susceptible to white nose syndrome because they're not hibernating in cave or mine systems where perhaps that fungus is perpetuating.
Okay, that makes sense. And let's see, we turn to Sharon, I believe, next. Sharon in Baraboo, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Well, my brother-in-law, who is our next-door neighbor, has spotted two skunks, and one is reversed color.
Oh.
Where the black should be is white, and it's got the black stripe rather than the white stripe. And underneath, the legs and underneath seem to be black. And then there's another one that's partially reversed.
Interesting. I certainly know or have seen, I just ordered some pelts for our teaching collection to use for outreach programs. And when I was on the website to order, you could order striped skunks with a thick white to white, lines or thin white lines. So there is some natural occurrence of different striping patterns, but I've not heard of any of the reverse coloring. So again, you know, just would you know, guess or hypothesize that that's a genetic, issue and
go from there. But that's pretty cool. Yeah. Pretty cool to see. Did you get a photo?
No, we did not. My husband saw one of them this morning. My brother-in-law has an iPad, and he did get some photos, but he's not too technically inclined to be able to send them to you. We might have to have grandkids help with that.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you don't want to get too close either. So
he got quite a few.
Yeah.
And we kind of laughed about, we were wondering if the scent was reversed too, but we were going to check it out.
Don't check that one out.
No, don't do that.
It's really it's really interesting to hear the calls and the different, you know, observations. And I think these are the types of things that will show up with the Snapshot Wisconsin project too, where you just really get some interesting wildlife sightings.
In the meantime, talk to your kids or your grandkids and get them to post that up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Yeah. I'd love to see that.
I would too.
Yeah. Okay, very good. We'll try to do that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, Cheryl in Eau Claire has an issue. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. I have a question about bats. I can see they're good bug collectors, but they give me the willies. When I'm sitting outside at dusk and I think, ooh, the swallows are coming home, and somebody told me, no, they're not swallows, they're bats. And they, like I said, they just give me the willies, especially when they come swooping in the house in the middle of the night. What do you recommend to get them out of the house? I mean, we've got good screens, we've got cap on the chimney, but they scare me.
They're probably coming in on the eaves, by the eaves, aren't they?
Yeah, Cheryl, they're in the attic of the home.
Our bug guy's been up there and he hasn't seen them, but
so almost for sure they would, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Do you have access to the attic through the?
There's bedrooms we do. But
so what you could do is get up there, even if it's on a ladder, and just opening the attic access door and shine a light and see if you detect any of them or their droppings, which will look something like mouse droppings. But if you were to crush them up wearing a latex glove and put them on a white piece of paper and use a magnifying glass, you would see that they were composed of insect parts. So that's a little hint for telling the difference between bat droppings and mouse droppings. But the bats, if they're taking up residence in your home, will almost always be in the attic. They do not want to be in the living quarters with people. And they also will typically be in the highest point of the attic at the peak and in small groups or clusters.
Because this is downstairs where if we're up late, all of a sudden something's swooping and then I get the big grin out and try to shoot outside, but it won't go, and then it just disappears on us.
So that's a little bit different situation. Somehow they are getting access, whether it's coming in through soffits, light fixtures, a tear in a screen. If it's just one bat, you know, at one time in the last couple of years, it could have been just a door left open and it accidentally got in there. But you don't, you really don't want to tolerate them in the living quarters or in the attic for that matter. So in terms of getting them out, if it is flying around and it's in a room, you can close down and put a towel under the doors of the other room so it can't get access, and you've got it kind of minimized into one particular area, and then open a window or a screen and let it go out on its own. You can also use a cardboard box if you can get it against a wall and put the box over a wall, and then a piece of cardboard that you slide between the wall and the box to create a cover. And then you can take it outside and let it go. But it sounds like, whether it's just an individual bat, that this is occurring enough that you have something going on where there may be additional bats in the walls or up in the attic, that it would be do you some good to, you know, explore for places where they're coming in and out. And one thing you could do is in the evening, have some friends come over and sit up on the corners of the house, and at dusk, look for bats emerging and see if you can find where they're coming out of the home. And that would be a good clue in terms of where you need to do some additional bat proofing.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing I just want to get out there to the listeners too, because this is a pretty common thing that folks go through at this time of the year, is that because of the threat of white nose syndrome, our cave bat species that David mentioned are threatened species right now. So from June 1st to August 15th, you cannot evict them from buildings unless it's a health hazard, in which you can get an incidental take permit. But have to do your exclusion before or after that time period.
Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests, they'll be with us right up till 12:30. Stay with us. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Jamie, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David Drake is also in that same department. He's a professor in Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension as well. Join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234. We've gotten lots of great photos up on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page, to take a look at the photos we have, and maybe you've got one you want to add, a wildlife photo, and I hope you'll put it up there. So you can also, by the way, email us at talk@wpr.org. I don't remember if I said that or not. Anyway, there we stand, and some pretty white deer. A shot from James Mooney. Just north of Plain, Wisconsin.
They almost look like alpaca.
Yeah,
a
they're
bit.
So
that long neck and that.
Yeah, don't they?
The way they're positioned, but yeah, they're white, all right.
They're white-tailed deer, all right, too.
Yep, they are for sure.
Tails and everything else.
Yeah,
for that matter.
They are truly white-tailed deer.
And some great shots. There's one that we can't figure out. Something is apparently building a nest along Jessica's house, and I can't figure out what it is. And
yeah, I think that would be an interesting one to see if there's some listeners that have some
suggestions
or thoughts.
Yeah, maybe we should describe it a little bit for people who might not be on Facebook right now. But it says, do you know what would make this? It is under our deck, and it's on some landscape rock, and it's made of a pile of thorny sticks, and it's added to every night. It looks like it's a type of nest. And Jamie and I and Larry were talking about this. We can't think of an animal that would do that. Jamie
on the ground, at least.
Yeah, on the ground. Jamie's got the best idea. Maybe it's a teenager in the neighborhood who's pranking you. But other than that, we don't have a good answer.
No, I'm sure there's an answer. I mean, some of the raptors build nests on the ground with sticks, but I can't think of one here. And in that particular location.
The best thing, if you have a trail camera, similar to what Snapshot Wisconsin, and in the Facebook picture, it looks like it's right next to a footing of a deck post, and that would be a great place to put a trail camera and just see if you can catch the animal or the prankster coming and going.
And let us know.
Yeah, that's right.
Once you
for
find
future
out.
Reference.
Trish in Madison has something, but then we have to go to, I have something from Scott Craven we should be bringing up too, but Trish has been waiting a bit, so let's go to her. Hi, Trish.
Hi there, Larry. Good afternoon to you and your guests. And so I have this question about frogs. We live in Madison near East Washington Avenue, and the closest source of water
to our house and yard would be maybe a quarter of a mile, a quarter to a half a mile away. And last spring, I heard a frog in our yard. And we have a little landscaping pond sort of thing. It's very small. And I heard the frogs in our yard, and lo and behold, a month later, there were tadpoles in our small pond. And eventually they grew up, and we got two frogs. I think they were green frogs. That's how I identified them. But my question is, how do frogs get from one place to another that was that distance apart?
How do they find those ponds? What do you think, Jamie?
It's a great question, and I would make the assumption, we'll let David chime in as well, too, but, you know, when, you know, a quarter of a mile, half mile, that isn't really, I mean, they're a small animal, but that's not that far unthinkable. But in the evenings, and if you have a rain and moisture in the ground and maybe a forest canopy, I mean, these frogs are foraging, toads as well, they're foraging at night, and moving around the landscape and dispersing from ponds where they, you know, were tadpoles and metamorphosized into frogs, and then are then, you know, going out on venturing and coming across the habitat. So I've certainly heard that story before from folks who have had landscape ponds put in their yard and then are inundated with tree frogs or other frog species that have found that particular habitat. So they move around and wander and come across these different wetland type habitats.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Scott Craven, a little bit ago, he was talking with me and he said, hey, could you help me help some people find some bass north, because he's got a little celebration going. And I said, well, I could see why you'd want me to come along.
He just wants your hot spot.
people want to catch those bass, but he's pretty good too, though. And he has got something going on that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so Scott is, if you're familiar, the Natural Resources Foundation every year offers field trips that folks can sign up for, and it is an amazing lineup. Larry, I know you've been on a few.
Oh, yeah, it's so much fun.
It's an amazing lineup of speakers and field trip offerings throughout the great state of Wisconsin, and the vast majority of them are occurring outdoors, so for the entire calendar year. So the Natural Resources Foundation is offering 188 field trips this year. You do need to be a member or make a donation to be able to sign up, and the trips sometimes have a cost associated with them, especially if there's a canoe rental or, you know, aspects like that involved or a meal. But there is still openings for a number of field trips, so I just want to mention that right off the bat. That website is wisconservation.org. And the field trip that Scott is leading, and there are still just a few openings, is bass in Northern Lakes. And it is going to occur at the Kemp Natural Resources Station, which is UW-Madison's Ag Station on Natural Resources. The date is Thursday, August 11th. The trip goes from 12:30 in the afternoon to 7 o'clock at night. He is bringing in fisheries biologists from the area to talk about the fishery, bass ecology and management on Northern Lakes, specifically Lake Tomahawk. And then he's got a flotilla of pontoons lined up, and folks will go out on a pontoon boat and have an opportunity to fish for bass. And it's going to be run as a learn to fish, so you do not need to have a fishing license. After that, you'll come back and Scott will show you how to clean bass, and then you will have a fish fry. It's not Friday, but Thursday, and you'll have a Thursday fish fry right at Kemp Station, which is just a gorgeous setting. The cost for this event is $75. It does include that dinner, and it is a fundraiser for the Natural Resources Foundation. So if you're at all interested, it's field trip number 144, and again, you can go to wisconservation.org and sign up for that one or many of the other ones that still have a few openings remaining.
You know, Scott and I have fished that at Lake Tomahawk together for bass, and there's a lot of bass in there.
Yes, there are.
Yeah. And he knows where they are.
He knows what to do.
He knows where they are, and he knows how to catch them.
Yes,
so
he does.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For $75, all that, the ride, the fishing, no license required.
Yeah, and he just has a lot of knowledge of the local areas, just the history and...
Just to visit Kemp Station is really cool. Yeah.
But we should be honest with the listeners. We have all fished with Scott before, and if he ever ran a fishing guide service, it would be called Every Man for Himself Guide Service, because if you're looking for help from Scott, don't expect it.
Well, not from us.
Not with us.
No, not us.
Not
that's
us,
right.
But
no,
I'm sure he'll be better about it, the people who sign up. And he knows how to put on a fish fry.
Oh, yes, he does.
He definitely does.
He will eat well.
Definitely. Well, let's turn to Jason in Menominee now. Hi, Jason. Thanks a lot for calling.
Hey, Larry. Nice to be on the show with you. I listen to you guys all the time. I drive truck for a living, so I'm always listening.
Cool.
I guess my question is, I've been a fisherman and been on lakes all throughout Wisconsin. I live on Taner Lake right now, and I've been on the lake and around the lake for like the last 20 years, and about, I think it was 3, maybe 4 years ago, we were sitting out in a buddy's lake house, and we saw a bird out there that none of us recognized. It looked like a loon, but it not like a loon. And we did some research, and it turns out, from what we think anyway, that it was an Arctic loon, which seems like is pretty rare because I've never seen one. And we've seen it now. I've seen it now every single year for the last 4 years, only by itself. I've never seen it with a partner or anything. I'm just wondering if that's kind of a rare bird around here, because I've never seen one, so I'm guessing that it is. But it looks just like a loon, except it's brown. It just has similar coloring, except a lot of it is brown.
Yeah. And Taner Lake.
On Taner Lake, just west of, or just north of Menominee.
I've been on that lake, too. Sure thing.
You know what, Jason, that's an interesting story. I guess my thought would be possibly an Arctic loon would show up once in a while, but they are not common and certainly not native here. For you to see it, you know, 4 years in a row, that would be highly unusual for especially a vagrant like that. And I'm wondering if you're not looking at one of the merganser species. And mergansers are... they can be kind of sitting low in the water. They're a relatively large-bodied bird. They've got a long, thin bill, just like a loon does. And I'm wondering if you look at either the red-breasted or the common merganser and see if that's what you're looking at, because that sounds a little bit more – well, certainly they're much, much more common, and they're very common birds on lakes throughout Wisconsin. But that is maybe what you're looking at.
Okay, I see. I saw, you know, I looked at a number of different birds that it could be, and I do have a bunch of pictures of it, so I'll have to send it now.
Definitely.
On Facebook. Because, like I said, too, the other weird thing was that the only time I've seen it, it's only been by itself. So there's never been I've never seen another one like it that looks like it, and I've never seen it with other birds. So I just thought
that's very cool. Well, so please send a photo. Then we can take a look at it too. In the meantime, look under merganser. I think that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I think the common merganser.
Yeah, because if you were a distance away from it, you'd swear from a distance that you were looking at a loon. You know, from a distance.
Yep.
For the fact that it's not, you know, doesn't look black and white like that. But,
yep. And I'll tell you. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jason.
No, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I do quite a bit of birding, and I'm pretty familiar with mergansers and loons, and sometimes, like you said, from a distance, the profile can be relatively similar, and I even have to sometimes do a double take to say, you know, is that a loon or a merganser out there? But yeah, I would look up at the common merganser and see if that's maybe what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I will do that, and I'll have the wife send something in on Facebook, because I've got pictures of it from several years, actually, different years.
Oh, perfect. I would love to see it for sure. Thanks.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot, Jason. Got a merganser, a wood carved merganser. I've got a lot of decoys, probably 60 or so.
Yeah, they're pretty birds, but you know they're one of the links between swimmer's itch, if you're familiar with that. And so it's nice to see them on the lake, but I always kind of equate them with swimmer's itch in some of these lakes. Yes, you start itching just instinctively.
Let's turn to, we got some good calls coming up here. John, Jeff, Elizabeth. Let's go to John next in Greendale. Hi, John.
Hi, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yesterday I was looking up at the sky and I saw this hawk, I believe it was a hawk, going, you know, soaring with the wind, not flapping its wings at all. And two blackbirds, I'm assuming they were crows because I could hear them cawing, just came in like a World War II fighter movie, you know, and they circle the hawk while it's circling, and then they start pecking at it. And I guess I have a couple. One, I would think that hawk could destroy those crows if it wanted to, but I've never seen it fight back. And two, what is it with crows and hawks that they hate each other?
Well, it's crows and owls.
Yeah,
and
crows. Yeah, so you got smaller songbirds that will drive crows out of a neighborhood. And you've got crows that will attack, just as you described, hawks or mob owls, if they can find them during the daytime when they're roosting and cause a big ruckus. And, you know, a lot of times they are just trying to move that particular species out of their habitat, out of their territory, to protect young or a nest or fledglings, and see them as a threat. And so they're just trying to encourage them to move on. So the crows will you know, make the vocalizations and caw and attract other crows, and pretty soon you've got a whole mob of them attacking that hawk, and the hawk decides nuts to this and and starts to move off and get out of that area. So it's just a mechanism to defend their territory.
Yeah, there you go. And crows hate owls. Yep. Owls can take them at night.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Crows don't fly.
Yep. 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 So it's an instinct to protect young or themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's safety in numbers. So the crows are smaller than the hawk, and so by mobbing them in, you know, multiple animals, you're a lot safer to do that than if you're doing it by yourself against a larger bird.
Yeah. So is it a mob or a murder?
I've seen the hawk or the crows go after owls too, but why doesn't the hawk fight back?
Just because there's additional crows behind it, and it's just overpowering. There's too many of the crows to fend them all off, and it's just easier to move on. Plus, there's still risk if there would be that, you know, encounter in the air. So, and Larry, the collective for crows is a murder of crows.
Yeah, yeah, I was thinking it was a murder.
But the action that they're doing is
a mobbing.
They're mobbing.
A mobbing action by a murder of crows. There we go.
We got to make that into a trivia question.
Yeah, we do.
John, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. I want to give Jeff a chance to get in, too. Jeff in Madison, thanks.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. So I was out paddleboarding on the Yahara River between Kaganza and Mud Lake.
Yep.
And I'm standing up on my paddleboard, and my wife is with me in a kayak. And I looked down in the water. It was still clear before any weed growth. And a sturgeon came finning by. That thing must have been about 6 feet long. It was just probably the most amazing wildlife I've ever seen, because that stretch as you go up toward Mud Lake is only about waist deep or 30 inches. It's really shallow. But my question, from an official point of view, when is something considered extinct in a flowage or not seen? I mean, how does that all work? I don't have a picture of it or anything. It just
we have lots
most
of
amazing
sturgeon.
Thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. Have lots of sturgeon in the Madison Lake chain.
Yep,
it is. Okay, I thought they were just in Winnebago, but they are still officially acknowledged in the Yahara chain.
Yeah.
Yep. I know people see them quite frequently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen them a lot.
I felt like I was back with the dinosaurs.
Yeah, they're very prehistoric, aren't they? With the rows of spines. Yeah, that's right. They're a neat animal.
And I got to put a plug in for that landing in Lake Kaganza. Every time I go there, I'm the only one that's ever there. And it's just a beautiful stretch, especially for paddleboards and kayaks. And it's a slow current. And you just have the place to yourself. It's just gorgeous.
Well, you may not have the place to yourself anymore, Jeff.
It is really, it really is a pretty area. Very, very pretty. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate the call. I had friends a friend who was learning how to scuba dive here in the Madison Lakes, and their first time down, there were like a dozen people. They go down and they say, okay, the instructor says, now get in a circle. So they're in a circle. They're getting used to breathing down. And about a six-foot sturgeon comes and swims into the middle. And everybody goes, oh, up to the surface they went. Lickety split. Oh, man. Elizabeth in Appleton, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I have an anecdote that might be helpful for people who are struggling with bat issues. I'm in Appleton, and I lived alone in a second-story apartment in the middle of Appleton where bats are very common. And they used to show up in the middle of the night, which was pretty unnerving. But I had kind of a scientific interest in not being unnerved, and I figured out ways to capture them and get them out of the house and so forth. But it took me a long time to figure out where they were coming in. And in the end, it turned out that they were coming in through the foundation in the basement. So I suggest looking there as well for access points.
Yeah, where the foundation. Yeah, that. Thank you so much. Where the foundation and the sill.
Mm-hmm. And really, really small crack, crevice. You know.
Yep.
A size of a dime.
Yeah.
Came in for years through the basement. Yeah. So.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Vicki. Vicki in Fox Lake. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that it can be a health hazard if you have a lot of bats that get into your attic. Their droppings can make you sick. I actually had, over a period of winters, I didn't realize that I had bats up there. And I ended up having to have all the insulation and all taken out and replaced, and that can be quite expensive. Fortunately, the insurance helped to pay for part of it, but it's something that if people are having problems with a lot of bats in their house, they need to be careful of.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Vicki, especially in enclosed spaces where you don't have much airflow. And you've got especially dried bat guano that when you start to move around in there, it falls apart and then it becomes more aerosol-like and gets up in the air. If you start
breathing that in.
Yeah, that's not good. And there's certainly there are some lung diseases like histoplasmosis and things like that that you can get from bat guano. So if you are up in those enclosed spaces, you may want to consult a professional who's used to dealing with that, or at the very, very least, go up there with some kind of a respirator over your mouth and nose that you're not actively inhaling that into your lungs.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. That's well noted. It's very good fertilizer.
It is.
Actually.
Yeah.
But you don't want to fool around with it too much. Well, what's the number of that Scott Craven bass fishing excursion?
Yeah, I think I looked this morning. I think there are four openings, and I think if there was a couple additional, I think you could twist his arm. So I think he was looking for about six. What was the cap on that? I don't recall.
I don't remember. 20-something, I think, I remember.
But I mean, what's the number for?
144.
144 and where
is the trip number. And they'll go to the Natural Resources Foundation website, and that is wisconservation.org.
And 144 is the number.
And 144 is the bass trip.
You will not regret going out on the water with Scott.
No.
It is a hoot.
I'd have more stories than he'd be the second best for sure.
Yeah. It is a hoot.
No, he's great. Yeah. He's a lot of fun.
Yes, he is.
A lot of fun on the water, and he knows what he's doing, so that helps too. We have, David and Jamie, you guys will be back again.
We will be in August.
In August, looking forward to that as well. David Drake and Jamie Dack, with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and with the University of Wisconsin Extension, and they'll be back. We'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, our consumer protection experts are going to be on board to tell you about the latest scams. Unfortunately, there's always some new things. It just makes you sick sometimes. But we'll talk about it and how you can avoid them. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.